country would be high up on the list of social wealth. Social wealth in the fact that people work alongside one another and the different ethnies with one another.
Okay, and what you are listening there is some of, or a few sound clips from various documentary films which have been made by Deborah Glynn, who is an up-and-coming, quite well-known documentary filmmaker, and I'm very lucky to have Deborah in the studio with me this morning. Deborah, you're very well... Dervla Glynn, and Dervla is here with me in the studio this morning. You're very welcome, Dervla.
Thanks for having me.
And I'll ask you just to pull a little bit closer to the mic and a little louder. That's brilliant. Thanks. Dervla, what is a young girl like yourself doing, going out to the Congo, doing documentary films, which are very, very scary, very well done, very interesting, give a fantastic message, but they are scary?
The situation is pretty harrowing out there. For me, out there, it's not really that scary. Like, life goes on in all of these places, in all these conflict zones. Like, at one point, people thought Ireland was a very, very scary place, and I'm sure it was if you were at the centre, the north. But it's what I'm really passionate about, and what's happening in Congo is that it's the second biggest war. It's the biggest war since World War II, actually. With regard to fatalities, there's estimated to be nearly 6 million people that have been killed since the 90s, but there's hardly any media that comes out of Congo. And
that's right, because I would have thought the Congo War, I mean, which I grew up with as a school kid, was over.
No. There's a huge war going on there, and it's a resource war. Congo is one of the richest countries with regard to resources in the world, yet it's actually the poorest country if you look at GDPs, you know, it's the poorest country in the world now, and there's almost 3 million people displaced living in refugee camps.
Now, the amount of violent rapes which are occurring in that country, I mean, I got a terrible shock when I watched your documentary. You went out and you wanted to speak to the men, to some of the perpetrators. Most people would speak to the victims, but you actually spoke to some of the
I spoke to the survivors of rape, and I spent time with the perpetrators. But for me, when I was doing research around the Congo, I've always been interested in the Congo, I felt like the men's voice was missing. And I think to look at the root of this violence and why is it happening, we need to talk to the men and talk to them about what happened to them and what's happened to society that this is happening. And a lot of these men were former child soldiers and forced to rape at a very young age, and then this rape became normalized and they continue to do so. And it doesn't excuse what's happening, but I don't think men should be excluded from the education around gender-based violence. I think on the contrary, they need to be included.
And why would Congolese soldiers have been forced to rape?
Well, this wasn't Congolese. These are rebels.
Oh, sorry.
Like, if you think of, I would say there's hundreds of rebel groups in eastern Congo, and all of these rebel groups are fighting for control of mining areas, the resource-rich areas. So there's big, very big rebel groups, which the National Army they're fighting the rebel groups, but then there's all these smaller rebel groups that form and come up, you know, overnight as well. So and then there is an issue that rebels can be absorbed into the National Army. And if they have a culture of, you know, and a history of raping, it's a big problem for the National Army that they're trying to wipe out this rape within the army.
Dervla, do you worry about yourself when you're out there, or do you have backup or security, or how does it work?
I tend to go on my own. I film everything myself, but I always have very good contacts, local contacts. I always work with people, local people, and I always have an excellent fixer who I work with, and really, you really need to trust these people, and they know how to navigate their way through situations, and they know people, you know. So it's like that's always the best way to do it. But no, I really believe in the work, and I've never had any issues, and I've always tried to be very respectful to people, and luckily I've always been respected for what I do, you know.
Because I remember speaking to Charlie Bird of RTE, and Charlie had done, obviously he was their chief news correspondent, but he had been in some danger zones, and he said it was very frightening. And one of the things that Charlie was very adamant about was that, that news organisations should take care of their staff when they are going into troubled zones. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree with that, especially when we look at what happened to Al Jazeera staff recently. And I think at the moment, you know, with what's happening in Syria and Libya, and many photographers and journalists have been killed recently and kidnapped and abducted. So at the moment, the price, I suppose, before there was a sense that journalists were protected. And I think at the moment that the people don't feel that you're anyway protected if you're a journalist. But I think, you know, you take responsibility for yourself if you're going into an active war zone. I personally take responsibility for myself and look after myself as best I can, and I don't take any personal risks.
Moving on away from risks and staying with journalism, do you think it's important for people who have, say, your gift and your knowledge and your ability to actually go out and document social strife?
Yes, I do. I think it's especially at the moment because... you know, everyone, you can go and document something on your phone now. You know, everyone has access to a camera. And I think there's a real power to like with social media, you know, everyone, it's given people a voice. And when you look at what happened with, say, the Arab Spring, you know, people really say that social media and people had a huge power in creating the that situation. So yeah, of course. So for me, I'm always very driven. If I see something, it's kind of, I'm really stubborn, I think, more than driven, that I just want to do something, I'll just go and do it. But I'd always encourage people, you know, if you want to do something, if you have an idea, if you see something that needs, you know, awareness being brought to, just go and do it.
Can you tell us a little bit more about you? I know you've also, and we have an interview coming up later on with Joe Murray of AFRI to do with fracking, but you've recently been involved in a project back in Ireland on fracking. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was really interesting, and I was actually delighted to have the opportunity given to me by AFRI to go and spend time in Leitrim, because I really didn't know Leitrim that well, and a beautiful part of the country. And very underpopulated, and I think only the population of Leitrim has risen since the famine in 2010. You know, so, like, this mass immigration again has hit the region, and then I think the region is kind of vulnerable to, you know, developers coming in, like Tambran are coming in at the moment, saying that they want to bring fracking into the area, and this will boost development, and there'll be hotels, and all this is going to happen to the region. But really, from what we look at fracking internationally, the practice of hydraulic fracturing, it's not a safe practice. And I think our aquifer would be in great danger if fracking was brought into Ireland in the north or in the south, because I know in Fermanagh they're further ahead. But, you know, water knows no boundaries, so it's worrying, it's a concern. So I spent a lot of time with local farmers, actually, whose land... the gas is under the land, so, you know, although you own the land, you don't own what's underneath the land. And they're very concerned that if fracking is brought into the area, that their way of life will be gone forever.
Now, Dervla, are local, or rather our national and mainstream news organisations doing enough to highlight some of these social demographic problems that are happening?
I think there has been some media. I think there has also been a PR campaign from the pro-fracking groups. But again, you know, I think that it would be nice to kind of, there's an onus on everyone to take responsibility for themselves and their own community. So what we're trying to do with this film is just to raise a bit of awareness and to let people know this is what the practice of fracking is. And it'd be great to mobilise a campaign. There is a campaign against fracking, and there's plenty of no fracking groups and No Fracking Ireland and Love Leitrim, and all these groups are doing great work. But I mean, it'd be great for people all around the country to get behind these groups in support of not bringing fracking into Ireland.
How important is it for independent documentary makers like you to exist, to give that different viewpoint?
God, that's a funny question. Well, I mean, I don't really think like that, but I think, you know, I'm really driven to do the work that I do. I think documentaries have a power, you know. I do think, you know, it's great. It's a way of raising awareness and you know, before, you know, I'd love to make a film that's just really happy and positive again, because that's just that's nice to do as well, to bring, you know, to show people what's going on in other parts of the world that are good, you know, as well as what's bad. But yeah, of course, I think it's important that documentary filmmakers exist. I hope the funding continues to last.
That brings us neatly along to my next question. And I'll just keep humming and hawing while you finish your coffee. Funding, where does the money come from?
Well, I've been lucky to get funding from the Irish Film Board and the Irish Arts Council in the past. Broadcasters like RTE and TG Cahir are brilliant. I'm doing work with them at the moment. And also now from like local NGOs, like AFRI have supported my work. I just got a grant from the Feminist Research Trust. So different sources like that, you know.
Is there any corporate funding out there? I mean, do any of our large corporate entities in the country fund, you know, people like you?
Well, I haven't come across it, but... you know, I
should
be
they?
Great.
Yeah, should they?
You know, give me a call if they do.
Talking about giving you a call, where can people see your work?
The Fracking Film is on the AFRI website, and then there's some of my work is not public. Like the feature Mali film is not just free online, but a lot of work is on. I have a Vimeo site, and a lot of work is online. A lot of the work is free. And there's a version of the Congo film on the ICCL website as well.
And not just because you're here, but I did, obviously, before I met you, I looked it up, the Vimeo site, and I Googled you and all that. It is very, very well done. So congratulations. Dervla Glynn, documentary filmmaker, thank you very, very much for coming into studio this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And chatting to us.